When it comes to legalizing recreational marijuana, Governor J.B. Pritzker has made his stance pretty clear.
I will work with the legislature to legalize, tax, and regulate the sale of recreational cannabis in Illinois.
But that process can be complicated. Today, we answer your questions about this issue. Plus, we have some tips for warding off the winter blues. How about cozying up with your favorite TV show, like Broad City?
Remember me?
Well, do you remember me?
Even less. You were just in here 2 hours ago.
Come on.
Well, do you work on commission?
No. Yeah, do you work on commission?
I said no.
I didn't hear it.
And it's gotten so bad for one particular endangered bee species that the NRDC is suing the federal government. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Have you had enough of winter? I hope not, because there's still plenty more weeks until the thaw. We know this is going to be another round of very cold temperatures coming across the state today. Lots of folks dealing with ice and rain. So today we are going to talk later about how to beat the winter blues. We want to hear from you, your suggestions. We've been gathering a lot of them on Facebook already, but we'd love to hear from you later in the hour. And we're going to talk about an endangered bee that's making its way to a federal court case. But first, all of last week and this week, we've been checking in with different groups to find out what they want from the new governor and his administration. Yesterday, we heard from educators from early childhood all the way up through college. And today, we're going to talk about the legalization of marijuana. It was a big talking point throughout the gubernatorial election, and Governor Pritzker has continued to tout his pro-legalizing stance. But what does that really mean for the state, and how soon could that happen? Dan Lynn is one of the people anxious to hear answers to these questions. He's the executive director for Illinois Normal, or the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws. He's joining us now from our partner station, NPR Illinois in Springfield. Hi, Dan. Good morning. Welcome to the 21st.
Well, thanks for having me.
Dan, how long have you all existed? Can you tell us a little bit about Normal for folks who are not familiar?
Sure. So Normal on the national level has existed since the 70s, the Illinois chapter since the late 90s, early 2000s in its current incarnation. And I've been involved as a volunteer since about 2002, 2003.
And so, as we've mentioned, Governor Pritzker has talked about this a lot of times while he was on the campaign trail. He even mentioned this during his inauguration speech from Springfield last week. He's received support from House Speaker Michael Madigan in terms of the legalization of recreational marijuana. What are you expecting now that he is governor?
Well, I think that we've really shifted the conversation and debate from should we legalize cannabis to how do we actually go about legalizing cannabis? Do we provide for sort of a cottage industry and allow for lots of entrepreneurs and mom and pop shops to open up? Or do we kind of keep it very regulated with high barriers to entry, similar to how we have a medical cannabis program that's extremely regulated?
And when we think about that and the medical cannabis program, certainly there's been lots of questions about that implementation, how slow it was. We've heard from some people how hard it is to have access. Are you worried that that will translate into recreational marijuana, those legal issues?
A little bit. I think that there's definitely room for improvement in the current medical cannabis program. But I think that once we bring an adult use program for the state of Illinois, I think that we'll be able to iron out a lot of those wrinkles.
Later this month, you guys have organized a lobby day at the Capitol. You're encouraging supporters to visit their representatives and senators. What's the goal for you for this lobbying day?
Well, we want to definitely push through legalization. We want to push through something that's going to be consumer friendly. And even amongst our base of supporters, we have differences of opinions about how we should go about legalization. Should there be some type of social equity and restorative justice as part of this program? Should we allow for individuals to cultivate their own cannabis at home? So a lot of those variables are things that even amongst our base of supporters that support legalization, we have differing views on whether we should have those involved in that type of a program.
Dan, earlier this morning, we had a chance to speak to Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton to that point of what you're talking about, the whole idea of restorative justice. We're actually going to hear the full conversation tomorrow when we talk about criminal justice reform. But I wanted to just play a little clip from that conversation. We put a listener question to her about what would happen to people who've already been convicted of crimes related to marijuana if statewide legalization happened. And here's what she said.
We want to make sure that individuals with misdemeanor marijuana convictions are able to get their records expunged, and we want to make sure that they can also qualify for small business loans and cannabis permits and licensing. And we also want to make sure that when we think about a cannabis equity program, that there are that we are very intentional about promoting Black and brown entrepreneurs into the ownership and licensing of new cannabis dispensaries.
Again, that's Lieutenant Governor Juliana Stratton. Dan, would Illinois Normal support the ideas that she's describing there?
Absolutely. You know, we want to see this be a way to end an injustice. And whether we're talking about cannabis prohibition or the broader war on drugs, there was a lot of racist foundation for how these laws were created. There was a lot of disproportionate prison sentences for who was actually going to jails and prisons for doing crimes that both Black and brown communities as well as white communities were committing. And we think that if you just legalize it without addressing any of those concerns, you're going to continue a certain injustice.
In the past, Governor Pritzker has also said there's the financial side of this as well in terms of the revenue, potential revenue it could bring to the state of Illinois. Governor Pritzker said that legalization could bring in more than $700 million to the state. I don't know how accurate you think that figure is, but I wonder what you think about other benefits for legalization as well.
Yeah, the tax revenue is really going to be dependent on what type of taxation rate the state puts on this product, how many businesses are allowed to operate. And I think that that's where, you know, you'll see a variation in those tax revenue numbers. But I think that we're really talking about creating tens of thousands of jobs across the state. I don't think it's going to be just limited to the Chicago and Chicago suburbs. I think that we can definitely see this be an economic boost for central and southern Illinois. We can see the differences in the industrial hemp farming impacting the rural community. And I think that that's something where, on the broader spectrum, ending cannabis prohibition is going to be something that's going to be economically beneficial for the entire state.
Dan, we have a couple questions that we've gotten from different listeners. And I wondered, in terms of when we're thinking about different questions around this, lots of people have questions. And our partners at the Illinois Newsroom did a whole live event about this last month. And they got a question from a listener from the Champaign-Urbana area that, and this person was wondering, who is going to get rich from selling and distributing? When you talk about jobs, who in particular do you think stands to profit the most?
Well, I think that the entrepreneurs that get involved in this industry in the beginning, that have that first mover advantage, will be able to capitalize on it the most. You know, developing a good brand, developing a good product, and a solid customer service is the recipe for success for most businesses. And I don't think it would be any different for this one.
And when we think about terms of potential costs, certainly, as we've seen, legalization in Colorado, if that's any example, you know, we've looked to Colorado to think about for revenues and for tax rates. But also in Colorado, we've seen an increase in vehicle accidents where drivers are driving under the influence. And we had another question from a listener about from Champaign-Urbana also asking about, there are already enough distractions and impaired drivers already. And I wonder how Normal is working, or how you would propose working with law enforcement to have the tools to police people who to prevent driving under the influence of marijuana.
Well, I think it's important to note that driving under the influence of cannabis is different than driving under the influence of alcohol. That being said, we would like to see some of the tax revenues go earmarked towards levels of law enforcement so that they can train more drug recognition officers. We think that the standardized field sobriety test is something that could still be used for testing if somebody's impaired by cannabis. But as an organization, we do not support people irresponsibly using cannabis, and that would include driving under the influence of it to the point of impairment. So while we do support consumer rights, we also want to make sure that we have safe roads for everybody.
Dan, can I ask you a question? You use the term cannabis instead of marijuana. Why is that?
Cannabis is the scientific term. Marijuana is a little bit more of a slang term. And for, you know, a solid decade that I've been involved in this effort, you know, we've always tried to root our arguments in science and facts. And I think that using cannabis helps establish that. Using the word marijuana or any of the other slang terms, I think it helps conjure up some of those negative stigmas with the subject matter.
Mm. One last question that we had from another folks, and someone else in Central Illinois, who was concerned about air quality. And the question regarding legalization, this was actually a question to Governor Pritzker, but was how do you propose to help protect air quality as the number of smokers in public and private places increases and all of that smoke gets put into the air? I wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Well, I don't think that cannabis would be treated any differently than tobacco in terms of the Smoke-Free Act, I believe it's called. However, if there are places like tobacco shops or cigar shops that allow people to smoke tobacco in them, generally the people that are inside those stores want to be inside those stores. And I think that we could see some type of social consumption lounges in Illinois. I know that that would be something that would be very beneficial for different communities that have been struggling to bring any type of economic driving forces to them. But I think that that's where we're not going to treat cannabis any differently in terms of people smoking in indoors or public places than we do with tobacco.
I wanted to just end by asking you, you said at the beginning that you think this is at a major turning point here in Illinois in terms of advancing Normal's agenda. What would you like to see happen within the first year of this new change in leadership in Springfield when it comes to legalization?
Well, we definitely want to see the bill get passed into a law. We want to see home cultivation be included in that law. I personally would love to see some type of social equity and restorative justice program, because I think that the war on drugs has been absolutely devastating for black and brown communities in Illinois. And I think that if we just legalize it and don't give them an advantage into this marketplace, that we are going to continue to do a disservice to those communities.
That's Dan Lynn, Executive Director of Illinois Normal, coming to us from WUIS in Springfield. Also in studio there is NPR Illinois reporter Jacqueline Driscoll, who's been reporting on marijuana policy throughout the state. Hi, Jacqueline. Welcome back to the 21st.
Hi there. Thank you.
So as we're just hearing Dan describe what he's hoping will change in terms of marijuana policy in Illinois, obviously one of the big motivators here is financial. And I mentioned one number the governor projected, $700 million. There's lots. Has anyone landed on a solid projection for profits if legalization were to go through?
No, not yet. We're hearing a wide range. Actually, we've heard anywhere from $350 million to $700 million. But we've also heard that it could, you know, create $1 billion for the state of Illinois. And as Dan mentioned, that a big part of that is we don't know how we're going to tax it yet if it does become legal. State Representative Kelly Cassidy and State Senator Heather Staines, who are kind of spearheading these this bill, they're both Chicago Democrats, have also been putting out some demand studies to just see what is the demand for the product, because obviously that's also going to come into play here when we talk about money. But there are no final estimates on how much money this could bring in for the state.
Dan, you mentioned the tax rate. I wanted to just ask you quickly about that. I know in Colorado, I think it's as much as 25%, if I'm correct, for a tax rate for recreational marijuana use. Do you have a figure in mind, or do you have any ideas of what Normal would like to see in terms of a tax rate?
You know, I think a 10 to 15% excise tax is appropriate. I think if you start getting close to that 20 or 25%, you're going to continue to have a gray market of people who continue to sell this and produce it illegally. But I think that 10 to 15% would bring in enough tax revenue to make it worthwhile for the state while still encouraging compliance with the newly legal program once when it gets here.
And Nyla, I'll also mention that in some states that also have legalized recreational cannabis also have something similar to home rules, where different towns or communities are able to place additional taxes. So if they want to turn people away from the use of recreational marijuana, they're able to tax it more as well. So I'm not sure if that's being considered here within the state of Illinois. I have talked to Senator Staines about it, but that's not a definite either.
And so you mentioned Senator Staines, Representative Kelly Cassidy, lawmakers leading this movement. Where are we at with this bill? I understand it's been promised early this year.
We don't know exactly when they plan to introduce the bill. We did see Representative Kelly Cassidy introduce a bill last year that did not make it out of committee, but that was gave us a little more insight as to how it might be taxed. They do want an excise tax similar to a sales tax, possibly where some of that money would go. That's all still being debated as well, but no word quite yet on when the bill exactly will be introduced this session. They do say that they want to have it introduced early because there will be ongoing negotiations. Obviously, we'll see a lot of people testifying in committee hearings. There is going to be a town hall that's hosted in Springfield on Monday, January 28th. I would assume that the bill is going to come after that because I also assume that they're looking for input from community members within the community of Springfield. And it's my understanding that they have been hosting these town halls, these discussions throughout the state. state. They do want to get a variety of feedback before they introduce the bill.
So there's a town hall meeting next Monday in Springfield, Jacqueline.
Yes, correct.
Okay. And I wanted to ask you, we had another question from a listener, and it's to Dan was talking about the industrial hemp program earlier that allows farmers to grow the crop as an agricultural commodity. Doug from Shiloh, Shiloh's about half an hour east of St. Louis, wanted to know about the law and how much hemp farmers will be able to grow.
That is still undecided. They have the Department of Agriculture just posted proposed rules, so it's still going through the rulemaking process. The rules are a bit wonky. People will be able to grow industrial hemp on contiguous land areas of 1/4 acre, so areas that are next to one another, and 500 square feet for indoor cultivation. So it's a little bit difficult to understand, but also not everyone throughout the state of Illinois is going to be afforded the opportunity to grow industrial hemp. There will be a strict regulation process. They will have to apply. They have to pay for application fees. They have to pay for each area of land that they want to grow it on. So they will have to be licensed, and it is going to be a strict program. This, again, does still have to go through the rulemaking procedures, could be sent back another time for additional looks. So they are hoping that farmers will be able to apply for licenses this spring. But again, that's still a little unknown at this time.
We have to take a quick break here, but when we come back, we'll continue this conversation with Jacqueline Driscoll. Dan Lynn, if you can stick around, too, I have a question or two for you from Illinois Normal. By the way, the questions that we've been answering from our listeners are folks who have sent in the forms to askthe21st.org. That's a new feature we've rolled out this year where you can ask questions you want us to ask on air. Some of them require us looking up things, taking a little bit longer lead time. But if you head to askthe21st, that's askthe21st.org, that's a good way to submit questions, and we're going through them and answering them on air. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Coming back, we'll finish up this conversation about marijuana legalization across Illinois. Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Right now, we're talking about the legalization of marijuana, or cannabis, if you prefer the term that advocates use, with Illinois Normal's Executive Director, Dan Lynn. Jacqueline Driscoll is also with us, both of them from our partner station, WUIS NPR Illinois in Springfield. Jacqueline, I asked you just before the break about this question that Doug from Shiloh was asking about this industrial hemp program. Just to be clear, can you explain the difference between hemp and how it relates to the cannabis plant?
Yes. So hemp is a derivative of the cannabis plant. So they are the same plant. However, there's a very important difference. Hemp has little to no THC, which is the mind-altering component that's found in marijuana. So as some have seen this as a baby step, you know, as the stigma changing with cannabis, hemp and marijuana, again, they are very, very different.
And, you know, Jacqueline, we talked yesterday on the 21st about the state betting too big on video gambling as a revenue generator. Some great investigative work by ProPublica Illinois and WBEZ and the Sun-Times looking at how much money was originally promised from video gambling, the social costs that have ended up happening from that as well. I wonder if there are lessons there that we should consider when we're thinking about marijuana, if it's similar.
Definitely. Obviously, when you talk about marijuana, almost the first thing that people also talk about with it is the money that it's going to generate. But again, we don't know how it's going to be taxed. That's very important right now. We don't know how much money is going to be generated, but we also don't know where that money is going to be put, where that tax money is going to go once it is generated. Some have said that it needs to go to law enforcement. Some have said that it needs to go to education. Others are saying, you know, just put it in the general revenue fund and let it pay off our pension debt and our other state debt. But we also need to take into consideration that this isn't going to solve all of our state's problems. And there are some other factors. When you talk to the Illinois Chiefs of Police, they're obviously very concerned with what's going to be seen on our roadways. They've also been talking to other states who have legalized recreational cannabis, and they are cautioning people to legalize home grow because it's causing people to grow large amounts of marijuana in their home, despite the law saying that they can only grow specific amounts. And it could possibly be bringing in gang activity. So they are still kind of researching that and the impacts that it's having on their society. So there are societal costs as well as the opportunity to gain money here for a state of Illinois that desperately needs it.
Dan Lynn, Executive Director of Illinois Normal, do you think that's a fair comparison to video gambling? I wonder your thoughts on that.
Well, I think that with video gambling, people weren't really doing that prior to it being legalized in Illinois. We already have lots of people consuming cannabis in Illinois despite it being illegal. I think when we talk about gangs and organized crime, they're already the ones doing the distribution in Illinois. And if we were to take this out of the underground marketplace, bring it above the table, those gangs and organized crime, they could become legal business folks. But I think that that's one way to help combat the organized crime and gang problems that we have in this state. I also think that once when you bring it out of the underground market, you now have mechanisms for dispute resolutions, whereas in an illegal marketplace, when there is a dispute, it's usually handled with violence, whereas in legal marketplaces, you don't see that. Where I live in Springfield, there's a CVS and a Walgreens directly across the street from each other, and I don't think that there's very much violence being happening there with those two facilities. Now, in different parts of Chicago and Rockford and East St. Louis and other urban areas, there are definitely violence that's associated with the illegal drug trade. And that's something that I think we could avoid if we were to take these products out of the underground market.
Lots of conversations that continue to happen around this issue. As Jacqueline was pointing out, if you're in the Springfield area, legislators have a town hall meeting about this on Monday. We will try to find out more information. Jacqueline, if you can send us that information, we'll try to put it up on our website as well at 21stshow.org. I want to thank Jacqueline Driscoll for being with us. She's a reporter with NPR Illinois. Dan Lynn, Executive Director of Illinois Normal, both of them coming to us from WUIS in Springfield. Guys, thanks for being with me.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
We know there's snow in the forecast again for this week and temperatures in the teens or lower for the rest of the week. It'd be easy this time of year to let winter weather get you down. So we thought we'd assemble a team of experts to give their tips on the best way to beat the winter blues. We've been asking you for your advice as well on Facebook. We've got a couple of Facebook comments to share and you're welcome to share with us now too. If you want to tweet or give us a call, our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. Our Twitter handle is 21stshow. How do you keep the weather from getting you down? I'm from Miami. I know that one way that I improve my mood is to get some sun and some heat. I love seeing green plants and trees around me, and you can do that right here in your local conservatory. That's a great place this time of year to do that. So let's start with the Quad City Botanical Center in Rock Island, just east of the Iowa-Illinois border. Amy Porter is its executive director. Hi, Amy. Welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for including me.
Amy, what's the temperature inside the Tropical Sun Garden atrium at your botanical center right now?
Right now, it is a balmy 82 degrees with the humidity equal to a wonderful summer night.
Okay, and I'm looking at my meteorological little clock here. So it's 28 degrees outside right now in Champaign or in Urbana. What lives in that atrium, Amy?
Oh, gosh, we have over 150 different tropical varieties of plants that live in our tropical atrium. We also have a 14-foot waterfall and a recirculating contained stream that has a group of koi fish. It is just a beautiful place to come, learn an awful lot about plants, feed the fish, get some summer sun in the middle of winter.
And what can you tell us more about other things people can do, not just within that atrium, but at the Botanical Center?
Oh, well, thanks for asking that. We feel like we're a garden for all seasons. We have definitely a great outdoor display, which is in blooming, beautiful color April through October. But we also worked really hard in the past couple of years to get people to understand that winter in the gardens is also very enjoyable and fun, and it can be very beautiful. So we've been very careful to plant particular plants outside that are just as beautiful in wintertime as they are in summer, also plants that provide food and shelter for wildlife. And so there's a lot to learn in the garden through every season.
Hmm. I'm thinking about a comment that we got from Liz from Bloomington Normal. We've been asking people for tips for how they beat the cold weather. And Liz said vitamin D, liquid supplement, and actual light is really important for her. I wonder, when we're thinking about kids, families, this is a good place for people of all ages, you said, to come.
Absolutely. And definitely wintertime is a tougher time on us physically because of the lack of longer days and not seeing as much sunshine. And that's part of the reason why it is important to get outside to have exposure to that vitamin D and kind of help boost our mood. We at the Gardens want to encourage kind of beating that cabin fever or winter blues. And so something that we do for families is we add a couple tons of sand. So the beach is back at the Quad City Botanical Center, and people can come and their kids can play in the sand, and they can sit back and enjoy a book or wander through the gardens and read the signage and learn all about different plants from around the world. Besides the special programming that we do, which includes Kinder Nature on Tuesdays for our younger demographic and our Family Fun Days, which is the first Sunday of every month, and that is a very family-oriented program. Always to do with nature, but everything from soil science to heart-shaped plants, which is something that we're doing for Valentine's Day.
And you have a beach, so that's another way that people can think about. You can go to the Quad Cities and go to the beach inside the Botanical Center. Amy Porter is with the Quad City Botanical Center. Thanks for being with us, Amy. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Exercise is another popular thing that everyone mentioned in terms of fending off the winter blues. We had a recommendation for hot yoga. You can head to the gym, or you can scale the inside of a silo at Upper Limits Climbing Gym in Bloomington. Michael Kerrigan is on the line with us. He's the general manager at Upper Limits. Hey, Michael, welcome to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Michael, what is this time of year like for you guys at Upper Limits?
So this time of year is really busy for us. We have a lot of students coming in for after-school programs. So we have two different youth competitive teams that we have. We have a fundamentals team and a traveling competition team. We also have two high school climbing teams that practice here regularly. So that's part of what happens this year. This week in particular is a special time for us. We have an anniversary membership sale coming up this Sunday. So every year we have a one-day-only membership sale and an event that goes along with it. So that's kind of a big deal for us. As we shift into February, we'll have some kids' day camps on President's Day, and we want to give back to our parents. So we have a Valentine's Parents Night Out camp in which we'll be putting on programming for youth so that parents can drop their kids off and maybe have a good time.
Oh, okay. So now you guys are built inside an old silo, your space?
Yes, so and I've been corrected by a lot of farmers in Central Illinois that this is a grain elevator.
Ah, it's okay. Thank you.
So we get a little bit back and forth on that. But in 1995, Chris and Pam Schmick opened up this facility in what was a white elephant for the town. And so we have 65-foot high climbing spaces in the previous silos.
And so people might not think of it as a social activity, but rock climbing is actually pretty social, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. We are family-focused, and we create experiences, and we have a community of young people and students and families that can interact while they're climbing and exercising. So it's definitely working out differently here at Upper Limits.
All right. So Steph, one of our listeners from Bloomington Normal, says getting out of the house to talk to people is one way she combats the winter blues. I wonder, are there folks who might be intimidated by rock climbing? We were talking about this morning. I haven't done rock climbing since I was in college. Any advice for folks who might be intimidated and want to start out and do this, Michael?
Oh, absolutely. You know, it seems like something that's not attainable for everybody, but it really is. You know, not only do we have climbing routes that are for all skill levels, we have, 3 and 4-year-olds that can climb up these walls. And actually, a couple of years ago, my mom started climbing at age 60. So it certainly is for everyone. Don't be intimidated. We have young and multiple generations climbing in our gyms.
That's Michael Kerrigan, the general manager of Upper Limits Climbing Gym in Bloomington. Michael, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So lots of, we've been asking lots of people different recommendations for what they do. I mentioned we've got getting out of the house, which is an important one, hot yoga, vitamin D. Tegan from Champaign says, KonMari style decluttering of my house has kept me busy and indoors all month long. Plus, the resulting profits from selling my unneeded junk on Facebook is a nice bonus. That's a great one, Tegan. The KonMari is the Netflix series that everyone's been talking about. It's how to declutter your home if you haven't heard of it. The last recommendation to that point of Netflix for beating the winter blues is a little less physical, because sometimes, let's be honest, sometimes you just want to sit on your couch and watch Netflix, and that's okay too. So we brought Eric Adams, the TV editor for AV Club, on the line with us to give his recommendations for the best shows to binge. Hey, Eric, welcome back to the 21st.
Hi, thanks for having me again.
So everyone's been talking about this KonMari series. I feel like that's the most popular thing on Netflix this January.
Yeah, you know, Netflix is really good at putting out those kind of feel-good reality shows like that, or Salt, Acid, Fat, Heat, or the Queer Eye reboot, which was also like a great way for beating the winter blues last year. So they've got a million people working over there. They've got an algorithm working in their favor.
the January winter algorithm of binge watching.
Yeah, yeah.
So when it comes to binge viewing, do you prefer familiar favorites or finding new shows to watch? What's your strategy with that?
Oh, well, you know, personally for me, as someone who has to watch TV for work, I have to find some sort of balance with it. And how that usually shakes out is that when I'm watching and binging at home, I'm usually going through old nostalgic favorites. My wife and I just completed a full run through Friends a couple months ago, and now we're in the middle of Frasier. So, you know, we hear those winter blues a-call-in, toss salads and scrambled eggs.
Oh, no. You should have sat, if you had sang that, that would have been perfect.
quite stylish.
So when we're thinking about nostalgia series, back in college, I used to watch X-Files every weekend with my roommates.
Ooh, yeah.
So I understand the entire series is now available on Hulu?
Yeah, I believe so. It's either it's on Hulu and, other supernatural favorites like Twin Peaks are out there. And those, you know, those are shows that, like, the X-Files in particular went on for so long.
Really long time. Yeah.
Devote your whole winter.
I think it went through all of college, all of graduate school. I feel like it went on a really long time.
Oh, yeah, and probably longer than it should have, you know, after David Duchovny took off and you brought the T-1000 in to replace him. It falls off a little bit there, but you've still got, like, five or six great seasons of that show, and there's 22 episodes per season there. So you've got a lot of time to stay indoors and investigate the paranormal alongside Scully and Mulder.
And speaking of Scully, Agent Scully, Gillian Anderson is the main character in Netflix UK show that's getting a lot of buzz. It's called Sexual Education. Can you tell us about that one?
Yeah. Sex Education is this British production that kind of dropped on Netflix a couple weeks ago without a lot of fanfare. They tend to do that. These British shows like Chewing Gum or The End of the Effing World will show up and take a lot of people by surprise. And in the case of Sex Education, this is a really warm, funny coming of age story about this kid, Otis, whose mother and father are both sex and relationship therapists. And he's kind of absorbed their expertise by osmosis. And he winds up kind of providing all of this relationship and sex advice to his classmates. And that kind of carves out his niche in this unfamiliar school environment for him.
We have to take a break, but when we come back, we'll wrap up with Eric and share a few more final shows that are binge-worthy potential for 2019 that you can be keeping an eye on as we're talking about how to beat the winter blues. One last comment we got from Facebook. Sunny from Champaign says, oddly enough, he makes a hot pepper ice cream. It is a surprisingly good treat for a few reasons. A nice sugar kick triggers good memories of summer for most people. Heats up your mouth and chest. And coincidentally, he just made a batch of Ghost Chili Vanilla Bean not 10 minutes before he posted that. All right, Sunny, we want to hear that. We need that recipe, I think, for hot pepper ice cream. Stay tuned to the 21st. When we come back, we'll continue this conversation. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We've been talking about how do we beat the winter blues. We've talked about exercise. We've talked about going to indoor gardens. Now we're talking about TV or Netflix and Hulu streaming services with Eric Adams, the TV editor for the AV Club. Eric, we've been talking about streaming services. What's new out on cable this January that you're excited about watching?
I'm very excited about a new Comedy Central show that's debuting tomorrow called The Other Two. It's created by Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, who are longtime Saturday Night Live writers. And it's about this brother and sister, Carrie and Brooke, whose younger brother becomes this sort of Justin Bieber-like viral sensation. And the show is all about them dealing with their brother's newfound fame and the way that he and their mother, played by Molly Shannon, kind of invade Carrie and Brooke's pre-existing, pre-established New York life. And it's just very funny. It takes a lot of unexpected turns. You might expect from a premise like this that the younger brother is going to be just this horrible little Instagram tyrant, but he's written and played just like a normal teen. And so it's very funny to watch the brother and sister kind of grapple with the way that fame is changing their family's lives and changing their lives in kind of unperceived ways. And it's a great pairing with the show that it's airing after on Comedy Central, Broad City, which is ending its run this winter and spring after five seasons.
Yeah, such a great show, Broad City. I loved especially, I have to say, I feel like it's not as funny as it started out, but what are we expecting for this final season of Broad City?
Well, the season premiere is one of those sort of format breaking episodes that we've come to expect over the run of Broad City, and it's a birthday episode that's told entirely through Abby and Alana's Instagram stories. So it's sort of formatted in that look that people have become accustomed to from stories. So there's emoji and GIFs on the screen, and they're just kind of documenting this day where they walk from one end of Manhattan to the other through Instagram, and all of the hijinks that ensue.
All right, with Abby and Alana, our last season with them. All right, well, thank you so much. What's the name of that other series on Comedy Central, Eric?
That other series is called The Other Two.
The Other Two. All right. So everyone can remember that, too. Eric is the TV editor for the AV Club. Eric Adams, thanks for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've probably heard lots of news stories about the decline in population here in Illinois. We talk about it here on The 21st. But today we're not talking about people. We wanted to talk about important animal species like the rusty patch bumblebee that are also struggling in numbers. So much so that the National Resources Defense Council is taking the federal government to court. The NRDC filed a lawsuit earlier this month accusing the Interior Department and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Services of violating parts of the Endangered Species Act, which could have preserved habitats that the bees depend on. Joining us now to tell us a little bit more about this in studio with me here in Urbana is Alex Harmon-Threet, a professor at U of I's Department of Entomology, and from the NRDC's Nature Program in Chicago is Legal Director Rebecca Riley. Alex, Rebecca, thanks for being here. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Nyla, for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Alex, before we talk about the lawsuit, can you tell us a little bit more about the rusty patched bumblebee? This is different from honeybees, for example.
Yes. So most people kind of forget that we have bees other than honeybees. But when you think back about it, you'll realize how many bees you see in the environment, particularly bumblebees. The rusty patch is actually a very pretty large bumblebee. It's really beautiful. It has this rusty colored semicircle kind of on one of its color patches that's outlined in yellow. So it's pretty distinctive looking. It's very large, too.
And then when we think about bees, we think about them creating honey. But what about their role also in bees like the rusty patch bumblebee as a pollinator?
Yeah, so I'd like to remind people that there are over 20,000 species of bees. So the rusty patch is just one of them. And most of those bees don't make honey. Honeybees do that, and we learn a lot about that in schools, but almost none of the other bees actually make any honey at all. They maybe have very honey. Bumblebees do keep very small amounts of nectar kind of in pots in their hives, but they don't actually keep honey or make honey that we would really particularly want to eat. Mm-hmm. But they're really important for pollination, right? And pollination is a really critical service that gives us all of these bright and beautiful things in our environment and actually supports life on our planet as we know it. You know, lots of things depend on plants and the seeds that plants produce. And if those seeds don't get pollinated well, then if those plants don't get pollinated well, then we don't have those seeds. We don't have those fruits to eat. And that's going to be a pretty dismal life for us.
Mm. Rebecca Riley is with us from the NRDC. I mentioned a lawsuit that organization has filed against the Interior Department and U.S. Fish and Wildlife. What is the Endangered Species Act supposed to be doing when it comes to supporting life like bumblebees, Rebecca?
So the Endangered Species Act protects species that are on the brink of extinction. And the rusty patch bumblebee is one of those species. In just the last 20 years, we've lost about 90% of the population, which is a really, really quick decline for a species. Now, this is actually our third lawsuit that we've filed about the rusty patch bumblebee. The first two were to get it put on the endangered species list. And so now that it's protected, what the law is supposed to also do is protect something called critical habitat. And these are special habitat areas that the law gives a higher level of protection to so that we can help recover the species and bring it back to a healthy population level.
And according to your lawsuit, what are you all alleging the federal government has failed to do?
So the law very clearly requires the government to do what's called designate critical habitat. And they do that by identifying certain geographic areas where a species lives and where perhaps it could live in the future that deserve this higher level of protection. And in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service hasn't even started to carry out that process. So what you would ordinarily see is a proposed rule and then a final rule designating critical habitat, and we haven't even seen a proposed rule yet. So we filed this lawsuit to force the Fish and Wildlife Service to carry out its responsibilities under the law and to protect these special habitat areas for the rusty patch bumblebee, which will also protect habitat for other species, including bees and other insects and wildlife.
And Rebecca, to be clear, this law was supposed to have been implemented last January, right? It's been an entire year?
That's right. So the way that the Endangered Species Act works is when a species is listed as threatened or endangered, it's supposed to get critical habitat protection right away. But the law contains a little bit of an exception where they can extend that for 1 year. So that's what the Fish and Wildlife Service did here. When they listed the bee, they didn't designate critical habitat, and they did that 1 year extension. But now we're far past when they should have designated critical habitat. And like I said, we haven't even seen a proposed rule yet. And so that's why we thought this lawsuit was really the only way to make sure we get the protections the bee needs.
Alex, Rebecca mentioned the huge decline. So we're looking at almost a 90% decline in the rusty patch bumblebee population over the last two decades. This used to be pretty common, not just across the Midwest, the rusty patch bumblebee, but also the Northeast, right?
Yes, it used to be a fairly common bumblebee, and actually some colleagues of mine said they used to see them in their yards.
And now, how important is a loss? How much do we attribute the decline to a loss of habitat? What other factors are also involved here?
There seem to be a lot of kind of interactive factors that are contributing to the declines of this bumblebee and lots of other species. Habitat loss is one major one, but then there's also pesticides. There's disease. There seems to be a lot of an increase in disease prevalence for these species as well. And then climate change, which is a major stressor that can basically exacerbate some of these other effects. Like if your body is constantly stressed, obviously you if you get a pathogen, it's harder to fight them off, and particularly if that's interacting with this loss of habitat and loss of forage for the bees, then they don't have any of the resources that they need to be able to fight off these pathogens.
So let's go through a couple of those. How important is having habitat in terms of a space for them, and how has that changed over the past 20 years?
So the habitat has certainly... There hasn't been that much of an increase in agriculture in the last 20 years, but there has been a change and an increase in the pesticides and herbicides that are used in those habitats, and that can have these, or an adjacent agricultural habitat, and that can have some negative effects on the pollinator populations. And then the disease, obviously, is something that spreads, can spread really rapidly. And when you have less habitat available, then the bees are interacting more frequently, and that actually can spread pathogens more rapidly. So mm-hmm. you actually can concentrate pathogens just by having less habitat. So these things, all, none of them individually is affecting the bee, but they are kind of working synergistically to really negatively affect their population sizes.
And then when we think about climate change, how is that affecting the bee population, especially across the Midwest, for the rusty patch bumblebee in particular? You said at the beginning they're kind of bigger bees?
Yeah, so large bees, they are in some ways more sensitive to increases in climate. Bumblebees in particular tend to be more diverse and larger and colder climate. So they, like in mountains and places like that, they used to seem to usually see more species of bumblebees. And so as the climate changes, that creates a lot of stress on their bodies because they're just not really adapted to really warm and warm temperatures, and so that can actually be really bad for them. They also need a long growing season in order to be able to make more queens for the future generations. And so if the temperature is highly variable like it is now, that can actually be really hard for them in terms of making it through a full colony cycle to have these reproductive.
So they don't even have a full population, a whole season to fully repopulate is what you're saying?
Yeah, so they need the full season. And if the weather is really variable, like we've seen in the last few years, where it can be really cold or it can warm up really in the spring and then get really cold again, those kinds of things can hit those guys really hard.
And so where across Illinois are we seeing populations now? You said they're pretty hard to find.
Yeah, so they anything pretty much north of Springfield is considered possible habitat for them. There is right now my lab is doing some work to try and look for these species in some of the central areas because we have populations of them kind of north near Kankakee and then some kind of south near Bloomington and Springfield, but then there seems to be a band where we haven't seen them in many years, and so we're trying to do some more looking for this bee to try and see where the population extends. Do they go into any further south than Illinois, or are they mostly restricted to the northern parts, kind of north of Chicago?
That's Alex Harmon-Threet with U of I's Department of Entomology talking about the work she's doing and helping us understand a little bit more about the decline of the rusty patch bumblebee population. Rebecca Riley with the NRDC, this lawsuit that you have filed against the federal government, what would be an ideal outcome? And I wonder now with the partial government shutdown, how that's affecting movement on all of this.
Well, the next thing that happens in a lawsuit is the government has to respond, and they have about 60 days to do that. So hopefully by the time that we get there, the shutdown will be over and they'll be able to do that. And what typically happens in these cases is we get a hard court-ordered deadline for the Fish and Wildlife Service to complete this work. So that means they will sit down with us and we'll talk about what's reasonable based on their workload, and, you know, come to an agreement about finishing this critical habitat designation.
Alex, just as we wrap up here, I wonder if there are people who are listening who think these bees don't even make honey. Why do we care whether or not they exist?
Yeah, the same reason we should care about all kinds of diversity in our society. It provides us with a colorful and vibrant life, right? If we have pollinators that are pollinating both the crops that we need pollinated, but also just the flowers that we need pollinated, that allows us to live in this very colorful world of with flowers that are blooming and birds that are feeding on those seeds that are produced by those flowers, and insects that are chirping and making other noises and providing us with other services like decomposition that we really need. We have to have a diverse planet in order to be able to survive here. And so they contribute, you know, they're just one piece that contributes significantly to this, to stabilizing our ecosystems.
That's Alex Harmon-Threet, who teaches in the Department of Entomology at the University of Illinois. I want to thank Rebecca Riley for being with us as well with the NRDC. She's the legal director of their nature program in Chicago. Rebecca, Alex, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Nyla.
Thanks for having us.
And that does it for us today. Coming up on tomorrow's program, we're going to be speaking with the new Lieutenant Governor, Juliana Stratton. We're going to hear about how she plans to approach the issue of criminal justice reform and what advocacy groups want to see from her and the Pritzker administration. Our website, 21stshow.org, is a good place to find more information about the show, to give us feedback. If you'd like us to ask questions on air, just head to 21stshow.org. That's 21stshow.org. We are a production of Illinois Public Media, and I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.